Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
Harvey Goldsmith, OBE, more than any other person, has been responsible for shaping the live music scene, not just in the UK, but in the whole world. An early love of music and an apprenticeship, staging gigs for bands in London and later in the US in the late 60s, led to a career that saw him promote shows for some of the biggest, most successful and influential acts in the world. He's worked with a staggering list of artists who over the years have included Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, The Stones, The Who, Fleetwood Mac, Pink Floyd, Queen, Elton John, Bruce Springsteen, Jeff Beck, David Bowie, U2, Coldplay, Muse. It's easier to list the people he hasn't worked with. He helped establish not only the idea of a professional touring circuit, but also the concept of the gig as a show, introducing production and staging that made huge stadium gigs possible and enjoyable. He helped popularise opera with his huge concerts for Luciano Pavarotti, and he was responsible, along with Bob Geldof, for making Live 8 and Live Aid possible. As if that wasn't enough, he was also behind the gig of the millennium, Led Zeppelin's now legendary comeback concert. Today's guest on The First Time is Harvey Goldsmith.
Do the dance sensations that are sweeping the nation at the hop. Let's go to the hop. Let's go to the hop.
I think the first single I ever bought was At the Hop by Danny and the Juniors, and that was followed by Rock Around the Clock, of course. It was so new and different, great to dance to.
Well, you can swing it, you can groove it, you can really start to move it at the hop.
Let's go to the hop. Let's go.
also love Miles Davis as well.
And I also love Miles Davis.
What period Miles kind of inspired you most? As an artist who went through so many bizarre permutations.
I think my all-time favourite pieces of music was the Carnegie Hall concert that he did, which was so extraordinary. And So What? And was the opening track. It was a period of that changeover of music from kind of traditional jazz into modern innovative jazz, and to have that piercing sound of Miles playing over this whole kind of group of musicians playing is exceptional. And he's probably above all most musicians I've ever heard had this knack of transforming you into another world.
You must be able to remember the first gig that you went to, or the first couple of gigs that really made an impression.
I think the first concert I ever saw was Louis Armstrong at Kilburn State, and it was a big venue. I think it's now a bingo hall. And then my parents took me to see Ray Charles at Hammersmith, which was pretty fantastic.
Was there an immediate feeling of this environment, this is exciting me, I have to be involved in this?
No, it was, yeah. It was completely the other way round. I went to see Ray Charles, and I was quite excited about it. The band go out, and they start playing, and then the Raylettes came out, and then Fathead Newman came out, and it was going on and on, and I'm sitting there going, where's Ray Charles? And in the end, Ray Charles played 40 minutes out of a whole show, and I was so angry. And I thought, there's got to be a better way of doing it than this. This is a complete rip-off. And I was really upset about it, and it kind of got my juices thinking that you can't do that to people.
And that was the thing that sparked you to start in your head when you first went to start staging these little societies and putting on bands yourself. Do you think this is where it came from, an idea of giving people this experience, this entertainment?
Well, I was angry about the fact that I felt you could do better than that, and I felt that, you know, he's come all this way and he should give his fans everything, but, you know, I didn't know the history and what state he was in and all that business, but there's still no excuse for it. And I started in my, you know, my musical career was really just, it was luck, timing, coincidence, and just rising to the bait and not understanding the word no, I suppose. I didn't really know what I was doing, I just did it.
Treat me wrong. Come and love your daddy all night long. All right now. Hey, hey. All right. You see the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing. All right now. Now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. Send you back to Arkansas. Oh, yes, ma'am. You don't do right. Don't do right. When you see me in misery, come on, baby, see about me now. Yeah. All right. All right. Oh, play it, boy. Thank you.
What's that? What's that? What's that?
The myth is that you, after college, you went to San Francisco to kind of learn your trade. And what was the scene like over there?
I was going to stand for president of the union, and my professor wouldn't endorse my candidacy, and I was very upset. So he sent me over to America on an exchange course as a SOP, because he said, I'm here to study, not to play. And after one term, I got fed up with it, and I bought a $99.99 Greyhound bus ticket, and I went from one side of America to another and ended up in San Francisco in the heady days of 67, when the whole hippie Haight Ashbury, all that whole love scene started, and I met a band called the Grateful Dead. From that point onwards, what I saw was as follows. Bands, as they grew bigger, could not keep playing the same places all the time. So when I first started in business, we kind of devised a circuit. We started off, we had a little club in Harlow called the Birdcage. And then from the Birdcage, we had a regular venue at Hemel Hempstead Pavilion, which was the old town hall. And we just do regular concerts there. And then we started the Crystal Palace garden parties. And what we do is we kind of take bands through this circuit. And then if they were really good, we put them on the garden party. When I first started in business, I actually didn't understand touring at all. I just couldn't believe how a band could keep playing. And in those days, it was 6 o'clock and 9:30 in the major circuit. How they could keep playing at their best every night. So I kind of concentrated on doing events in the very beginning. And with touring, I felt that you had to chop and change. You couldn't just keep going back to the same venues year after year after year, because it just became boring. It's boring for the acts, it's boring for the audience. So I like to mix them up. So the classic example was doing two Wembley stadiums with Queen, and then the next tour they did was a tour of the ballrooms around London, like the Tottenham Royal and Streatham and places like that, you know, 2,000 stand up venues. And then the next time we play with them, they played, we did Nebworth. So I just felt that you couldn't keep going back to the same, and it's a bit of a problem today, because acts just go back and play the same gigs time after time after time. And at some point, you've got to chop and change. And I think that keeps the energy going. But equally, as the bands developed, in England particularly, more than America, we developed a style of presentation that involved a show. And whether it was the Pink Floyd, whether it was Emerson, Lake and Palmer, whether it was Yes, or indeed the Nice before the LP, they were the forerunners, and even Genesis, when they first started, always had a show. And the show evolved a set and lighting and whatever. And then the Stones, as they developed, started doing that as well. And they realised at a very early stage, I remember doing a show with Emerson, Lake and Palmer at White City, and the album that was out was Manticore, and which was this strange kind of armadillo type tank. And we were deciding what to do, and I remember sitting with the boys and saying, well, you know, we need to do something of a set. And they said, can we build the cover, which was this peculiar Manticore. And I said, sure. So we built these massive, great kind of tank-like armadillos, and they fired, you know, stuff into the audience and all that. But you had to do that. You had to fill that stadium. You had to believe that, you know, when you're doing 20, 30, 40,000 people, or if you're playing Wembley, you know, 75,000 people, you had to think about the guys the furthest away, as well as the, because the people in the front are in the middle of it. And you have to get to the people at the edges, and you have to give them some kind of spectacle that would really make it work. And it was either lights or set or a combination of both, and then the music fitted around that.
There are some bands who you've got a very close association with, bands you've worked with for a very, very long time, one of them being The Who. How did that relationship first start?
I got involved in the, what was the NJF, it's now Reading Jazz Festival. They were playing at Plumpton, did one show that wasn't at Reading, for some reason or other. And I ended up being a kind of stage manager on stage and met them. And then when I teamed up with John and Tony Smith, they were promoting The Who, and they were actually promoters of The Stones as well. So when we teamed up with them, I took over doing The Who and The Stones and various other acts. And we just became friends, and I just loved working with them. They were just such an exciting band, and today they still are.
So the very first band you promoted, what was that gig?
I think the first commercial event I did was a festival which we did with CBS Records, which was It's a Beautiful Day, Earth, Wind and Fire, and a Mahavishnu Orchestra. And we did shows at the Roundhouse Sunday nights, and then from there we did Hemel Hempstead Pavilion, and then we bought this club called the Birdcage in Harlow, and then we started the Garden Parties in 69. So I was working with bands like The Move and The Action and The Moody Blues and Fleetwood Mac and Groundhogs and Alex Harvey and Thin Lizzy. Everybody. Mark Bolan, he was a favourite.
What was so great about Mark?
He was a character. He was just an extraordinary character. He was a real showman on stage. And unlike working with the Pink Floyd or The Who, which was a different kind of energy and music, you had to love him. And he had this kind of attitude, and he was really quite sheepish, really. He got on that stage and he just kicked ass. A kind of mentor for a lot of artists.
David Bowie included?
David Bowie, yeah. And they all saw what he was doing, and they thought, well, yeah, great.
Sunday. town. Ride a white swan like the people of a Belgian. Where you head on, baby, can't go wrong. Take a bright star and place it on your forehead. Say a few spells and baby, there you go. Take a black cat and sit it on your shoulder. When in the morning you know you know. Tattooed gown, ride a white swan like the people of the Belgian. Wear your hair long, baby, can't go wrong.
And Live 8 is obviously legendary. What were your first impressions when you first met Bob Geldof?
I hated with a passion the punk era. Just hated it.
Not even the kind of passion and the attitude didn't speak to you at all?
To me, it was the revolution of the uglies, and I just hated it. And when the Sex Pistols came into my office, I chucked them out. I just didn't want to know about it. But there were three acts in that whole mess that I were musical acts. One was The Clash, one was The Jam, and funnily enough, the third was the Boomtown Rats. And I just loved the band, and I loved the music, and it was kind of really coming out of that era. So I worked with the Boomtown Rats, so I knew Bob pretty well. So when Live Aid came up, everybody was aware of those pictures on the news because no one had ever seen that before. And then Bob did the record and whatever. And so it was only a matter of time before something was going to happen. The reason why I was being difficult and couldn't get into it earlier because I was just knee-deep in work. I mean, at that period, I was looking after Roger Waters, who'd split from the Pink Floyd, and he was doing his first solo project in New York. At Radio City, I was taking Wham to China. It was the first pop group ever to go to China. I had Bruce Springsteen on at Wembley Stadium, and then this came up. I just couldn't get my head around it. So I kept saying to Bob, you know, when he first asked me, I said, "Look, I can't think about it at the moment. And really, I'm going from shows in England to New York. From New York, I'm going to Hong Kong. Then I'm going to China. I hope." Because it was still up in the air what the hell was going on. And then I got Bruce Springsteen on at Wembley Stadium, who it was the first time he played that and was always wanted to play only indoors, which was easy. And suddenly he wants to play Wembley Stadium. And so I was just up to my neck in it, and he kept kind of haranguing me. And then literally the morning I got into the office after I got back from China, he was banging on the door and just said, "We've got to do it." And at first I thought the bloke was mad, and then I realised that obviously there was so much demand because the record was being so successful. And that was all fine at first. We're going to do a show at Wembley Stadium, and I thought, well, at least we'll have the artists that played on the record would turn up, or some of them would. So I wasn't that worried about London. When he said we've got to do two shows, it really pushed me into it. And I'm a person that spent my whole life never saying no, and I love the challenge. So there were two sides of me. One was he was barking mad, and the second thing is, why not? So there wasn't time to think about it. You know, it was 10.5 weeks from start to finish. None of us knew what we were doing. We were bulldozing our way through, and we just got on with it. It was quite strange, really. We didn't have time to think. Certainly didn't have any sleep for 10 weeks. We finally got some acts who said yes, because we went to this press conference at Wembley Stadium in the ballroom there. There were about 400 people there. Cameras like I've never seen in my life before. And the only act I knew were playing were the Boomtown Rats. And then I was sitting next to Bob, and Bernard Doherty was a PR guy, and he was saying to Bob, you know, the question was asked, you know, who's playing? He rattled off his just name, and I kicked him so hard under the table, because I knew he was just like, I mean, it was just nonsense. He was like, Pink Floyd are playing, yeah, Paul McCartney's playing, oh yeah, Elton John, whatever. And I just looked at him, I thought, but it was one of those things, I think it wasn't a difficult sell, in truth, because everybody was touched by those pictures. And the fact that we were talking about butter mountains and fruit mountains, and now to get rid of it, and down the road there were thousands upon thousands of people who were just starving, it was just completely nonsensical. And we'd never seen that before. No one had ever been aware of it. So it wasn't difficult.
With the problems in the house and wife, and he can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to die? Oh, when the silicon chip inside a hand gets switched to overload. Oh, and nobody's gonna go to school today. She's gonna make them stay at home.
Saying feed the world, there are 11 million people starving in one country. Doesn't it make you think? Merry Christmas, everyone.
Hello, this is Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet. Happy Christmas, everyone.
This is John Taylor from Duran Duran. Happy Christmas, everybody, too.
Hello, this is Paul McCartney. Sorry I can't be with you.
I can't get the last right, Bob.
Hi, this is Simon from Duran Duran. I'd like to say, I'd like to wish you a happy Christmas.
Okay, well, this is Bono here, the singer with U2, wishing you a happy Christmas and a Merry New Year. Is that right?
Hello, this is Paul McCartney. Feed the world. No, it's good. Sorry, I can't remember that.
Hello, I'm Shimon. Happy Christmas.
I'm Sarah from Banana Rama. Christmas.
And from me too, Karen.
I'm Paul Weller from the Style Council. I wish you all a happy Christmas.
This is Johnny Fingers from Boomtown Rats, and I'd like to wish everyone a happy Christmas.
Hello, this is Mature from Autobox. I forgot there was some other groups here today. Just have a good Christmas and enjoy yourself.
Hello, this is Stuart Adamson.
This is Tony Button.
This is Mark Brzezinski.
This is Bruce Watson from Big Country.
Feed the people, stay alive.
Hello, this is Glenn Gregory from Kevin 17.
wishing everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
This is David Bowie. It's Christmas 1984. And there are more starving folk on our planet than ever before. Please give a thought for them this season and do whatever you can, however small, to help them live. Have a peaceful New Year.
Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on Six Music. And as if you needed telling, that was Feed the World by Band Aid from 1984. Played as my guest this week is legendary concert promoter and one of the masterminds behind Live Aid, Harvey Goldsmith.
This record was recorded on the 25th of November, 1984. It's now 8 a.m. on the morning of the 26th. We've been here 24 hours and I think it's time we went home. So from me, Bob Geldof and Midge, we'd say good morning to you all. And a million thanks to everyone on the record. Have a lovely Christmas. Bye.
Clearly one of the defining and most ambitious events in live music history, I asked Harvey all about Live Aid and specifically the Philadelphia leg of the concert.
The American show was tough. It was very tough because America's an insular country. And the first part of America is if it's not invented here, it's no good. That is a serious problem they have. And the second part is they have a different way of attitude towards cause shows, and they didn't do that many anyway. So I probably spent more than 50% of my time getting the American show together.
What was the highlight of the event for you musically?
When it was finished.
Do you think there'll ever be, if you got asked to stage another one, would you stage another one?
There's always another one. You know, we did Live Earth. I did a whole string of huge event shows. You know, we did that tribute to Freddie Mercury. You know, we worked on Live Earth, and then Live 8 was 10 shows at once, and so was Live Earth, and that was difficult. That was very difficult. And funnily enough, on Live 8 was the complete reverse of Live Aid. In Live 8, the only reason we did it is because we got besieged by acts who kept phoning up saying, you've got to do this. So when you get Bono and Elton John and McCartney and Madonna saying, you've got to do it, I guess you kind of, somebody's going, hello, better do something. We didn't want to do anything.
Bit in the future, maybe?
But there's always a few. You know, unfortunately, I mean, you know, if you look at today, and there already been a lot of conversations about, can we do something for New Zealand, which was trashed by an earthquake. Now you've got Japan, it's been trashed. There's all that flooding in Australia. There's all the, you know, the whole Pakistan flooding situation really is kind of under the table. Nobody even talks about it, and yet thousands upon thousands of people were killed and villages destroyed and all the rest of it. So unfortunately we live in a world of turmoil. And the thing about music is quite strange, because as bad a reputation as music has in the world or is created by the media, it's the musicians are always the first to step up to the plate on a cause and say, hey, you know, we're standing up to be counted, and how can we help and what can we do?
Big birds flying across the sky, throwing shadows on our eyes, leave us
Another band who you have a close connection with is Led Zeppelin, a band who seemed to, at the time of their initial peak, the scale of the group seemed to dwarf everything else in its wake. Can you remember seeing them for the first time, or was that a relationship maybe with Jimmy before they became Led Zeppelin?
Strangely enough, the first time I saw Led Zeppelin is when I promoted them. That's the weirdest part of it. They were, again, they changed the whole definition of performance. And they were one of the few groups that knew how to fill a large space with sound and energy and excitement. And they were just magical. And of course, you know, those great songs of Led Zeppelin will endure forever. And the whole ethos of what they stand for and what they did and how they performed. And again, there was always an edginess about them. I mean, to me, the best bands in the world are those that every night something else happens and you never quite know what's going on. And the fact that you could be in the back of, you know, of 60, 70,000 seat stadium and still feel it, that to me is a fantastic group. That's the key to the emotional side of music, which gets to you. And with Led Zeppelin, they never failed. I mean, even on bad nights, they never failed. And it was quite strange, because when I finally got them back together again to do, you know, the show at the O2, there was one other person who'd ever been involved with them that was involved in that thing. And when we did a full production rehearsal, and it was so incredible. And I went out to them, I said, that was just pretty amazing. I said, and they all, you know, they were all talking to each other. I said, you probably don't remember where you played and when you played before, but you certainly remember this one. And they had an aura about them that was just different.
How did you get on with Peter Grant, the notoriously hard-nosed manager?
I actually got on really, really well with Peter, and he loved my wife. My relationship with Zeppelin is just really bizarre. He apparently had spent 6 months trying to find me, and he kept calling the office, and the receptionist, because he was a little bit abrasive on the phone, the receptionist would never put him through to me. And I was walking, his office was in Oxford Street, and I was walking along Oxford Street one morning, and I saw Peter. I said, oh, hello, Peter, how are you? And he came up to me and he said, what do I have to do to get through to you? I said, sorry? He said, I've been calling you for 6 months. And he said, I'm not talking to you. I said, what do you mean you've been calling me? He said, every time I call, you're not in, you won't answer the phone, you won't... I said, it's the first I've heard you called. It was really embarrassing. It was just very funny. I went back to the office. I said, what the hell's going on? Did somebody called Peter Grant ever call? And the girl said, oh, yeah, he called a few times. But he was so rude, I didn't want to put him through. Oh, no. Anyway, we patched it all up. And it was hard work taking that group on the road. And on the last tour that I did with them, which we took, went right across Europe, I ended up being the kind of the promoter, the tour manager, the advance guy, and got very little sleep. But he was, he had a very funny side to him, Peter, and we just kind of became friends. And he was an extraordinary bloke, a really extraordinary bloke. But he had a vision in terms of how he managed the band and how that band was perceived that no one had ever had before that. And he changed the whole face of how the business worked.
We mentioned it earlier. We mentioned Led Zeppelin's reunion in 2007 at the O2. Something that had been touted for years and years and years. Can you remember first getting the phone call from someone going, this is going to happen?
It wasn't. Well, it wasn't going to happen. Armut Ertegun was my mentor in America. And he was the head. He founded Atlantic Records. And I was very, very close to him, and I went to the memorial service, which is held in New York, and every act played except Led Zeppelin, near enough. Afterwards, I saw his wife, and his wife said, look, you know, Armut was always so fond of you, and he said, the one thing he would have been did, because I said, there's only we can do. He said, the one thing he would have been so proud of is if you could do something for him in London. Because in America, if we want to do a concert, because this was just a simple, you know, memorial service, it's going to be a nightmare and I'm going to have to deal with all the hangers-on and blah, blah, blah. He said, but doing something in London, he'd be very proud. And I said, done, it's my honour. So we started off looking at going through the Atlantic roster. We were talking about doing a show with Genesis and Eric Clapton, and Eric said, I'm going to put Green together. And then, you know, we were talking to the Rolling Stones, trying to get, you know, so we went through the whole, and the idea was to do 6 or 18 acts all doing something. And then I talked to Bill Kirbishley, who's the Who's manager and was Robert Plant's manager, and I said, the only act that's not doing this is Led Zeppelin, and they're the only band that Army absolutely adored, and they should do it. And all each of the musicians had their own manager, and they said, oh, we can't do it, whatever. And I said, I sat in the office one morning and said, I've had enough of this. So I wrote them all a personal note. And I said, forget about touring, doing, recording, filming, blah, blah, blah. Do it for Armit, because he was your guy. And I said, at the time we were looking to do half an hour. And I said, you know, 30 minutes of the whole band together, or the band with, and I knew that John Bonham's son was a fantastic drummer, and they all liked him anyway, so I knew that was an option. And 30 minutes after the letter came out, I got a phone call from Jimmy Page, said, yeah, we're going to do it. And then I got Robert called, said, yeah, we're going to do it. And that's how it happened. And then they all met and they said, look, first of all, we don't know if we can do it. That's the first question.
Yes, so we're
going to go and disappear for a couple of days and just work out, see if we can do something, and then we'll let you know. Okay. So about 2 weeks later, I get a phone call, go down and meet them all, and Jimmy said, we did 3 days of rehearsals and we're going to do it. I said, oh, fantastic. And I said, well, you know, you've got so much material to choose from. And they said, no, we want to do the whole show. And I just said, back and I went, oh, wow, done. And that was it. And then at that point onwards, it didn't make sense to do anything else. And we just decided that was the show.
In 1986, you promoted Luciano Pavarotti at Wembley, and then you went on to do Carmen and Tosca and Ada. When did your love of opera first arrive? Because it's an unexpected move from the outside.
I'd always had a kind of Catholic taste in music, so it was pretty widespread. My distant family were very much involved in opera. Some people listen to music for sound. Some people listen to music for sound and the lyrics. And I look at music as entertainment. Pavarotti came about very simply. I had booked 10 nights at Earl's Court to present 6 shows with Bruce Springsteen. And Bruce Springsteen then decided for the first time ever that he wanted to play open air. He didn't believe in open air, hence Wembley Stadium.
Which was a record-breaking show in itself, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I got stuck with 10 nights at Earl's Court, and I literally had the whole office scrabbling around. We were looking at car boot sales, we were looking at mass orchestras, we were thinking of military bands, we were looking at anything. I'd already paid for 10 nights at Earl's Court, very expensive. And I was looking around at anything, and then somebody in the office said, have you heard of Pavarotti? And I said, you mean like Caruso? He said, yes, yes, yes. He said, he's just played Madison Square Garden. I said, get him. it was like that. It took me 6 months to finally persuade his manager that I was credible enough to talk to him, let alone do a deal with him. And he finally came over and I did a deal with him. And we talked about dates. And he said, the only date I can give you, I think it was either the 3rd or the 8th of August. And I thought, well, Earls Court's not really that busy in August, so I'm sure the least they could do is stretch my tenancy, so I'm going to get one or two shows out of it. And I said, yeah, okay. And we're talking away, and I said, look, we need to get on sale pretty quickly, and I need artwork, and I really need to get this going, and what can we talk about, an announcement and so on. And he looked at me and he going, what are you talking about? And I said, hey, you know, it's not long till August. He said, which August do you have in mind? I said, this. He said, don't be ridiculous, dear boy. We work 2 years ahead at best. He said, I'm stretching it by giving you a date the following year. And I looked at him and I said, I don't have Earl's Court the following year. It suddenly dawned on me that he wasn't talking about 1984. He was talking about, you know. Anyway, I thought, oh, to hell with it. And I was quite intrigued. I'd started to read about Pavarotti, and, you know, his voice was stood up for itself. And anyway, we ended up playing Wembley Arena, and it was amazing. It was quite extraordinary. And I just struck up an instant friendship with him, and I worked with him until, unfortunately, he died.
Jeff Beck is someone that you've now got a very close association with, you're managing. When did you first meet Jeff? Because his path threads through kind of British rock and roll since, well, right to the start, pretty much.
Yeah. Jeff and I have been kind of friends for a long time. I did some Yardbird shows. I did a Beck Bogart and a Peace tour. I worked with him on and off, and I'd always respected him, and he was quite an extraordinary character. And then I put the Arms tour together for Ronnie Lane, who had multiple sclerosis, and we put this tour together, which was an extraordinary lineup of Pete Townsend and Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck, and it was heaven. It was everybody you could think of. We did this tour. Jeff and I kept crisscrossing. We'd always bump into each other, and, you know, whatever. We were both being given classic rock awards, and we met up there. And then I was in America, and I got a phone call, and Jeff said, you know, where are you? I said, I'm in America, when are you coming back, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I'd like to meet up with you. And we met up, and he just said, look, I feel quite frustrated because I'm not going anywhere. And I've been with the same management for a long time, and I just think it's just run its course. And I need some help. Can you help me? And I said, well, I'd like to think about it. And I started asking his agents what he'd done over the last 4 or 5 years, and three sheets of A4 paper came back. And I said, okay, where's the rest? And he said, that's it. And I said, that's ridiculous.
This is Jimi Hendrix's favourite guitarist. Come on, what are you doing here?
So I realised that he was probably the most underexploited guy on the planet. And we talked about that, and I said, look, what do you want to do? And he said, you know, I want to do a new album. I want to work, and I want to get some respect. He said, I've always been on the sidelines. I said, it's got nothing to do with you, has it? You big on the sidelines. He said, well, maybe. But he said, I've never really had it. I haven't had any direction for a long time. Whatever. Anyway, we sat down and we plotted it out, and it was like a jigsaw puzzle. It was amazing. And we just completely rebuilt his career and his life, and he's just having a ball at the moment.
Have you got a favourite, or one of your favourite Beck moments? If we're going to play something, could be from any era, any band, any one of the newest bands at all, present day.
Funnily enough, his mentor was Les Paul. When Les Paul died, he kept saying to me, I really want to do something for Les Paul. And we talked about it a bit, and he said, and I'd like to, he used to play in this tiny little club, 150 seats in New York, called the Iridium, and he played there every Monday night. And Jeff said, I want to do something there, can we make it work? And I said, well, on its own you can't do it, but we should film it. Wish we did. We did two nights last June at the Iridium, and he fell in love with Imelda May and her voice, and he'd worked with Imelda, and he had recorded with Imelda and Daryl, and he said, I want to do it with them. and I want to recreate the original Les Paul and Mary Ford parts. And we couldn't sell any tickets, so we just invited people. There were 35 guitarists there. You know, from Kurt from Metallica actually flew in from Hawaii, and Steve Van Zandt was filming in LA, he flew it. I mean, they just didn't ask them to, they were coming out of the woodwork just to see the hero. It was an amazing show. And there's one track on there that I just can't get out of my head, which is Walking in the Sand, the old Shirelles number, which Imelda and Jeff do. It's just in my head all the time. It's such a great track and an amazing guitar solo.
Firsts, now it comes to the last. You get to choose the last song as well. It'll be something that maybe a song that means a lot to you from your life, or a band that you particularly loved over your career.
I guess the Who. Who are you?
What is it about that song?
I don't know, it just brings back so many memories, so many shows with them, and such a lot of fun and excitement.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.